Hello, I'm Megan Morris-Carter, Director of The Hill. Welcome to Series 3 of our Digital Innovation podcast. The Hill supports an ecosystem of startups, scale-ups, partners, and clinical staff interested in digital innovation, as well as managing a pipeline of innovation into Oxford University hospitals and the wider NHS. Our work supports better patient care through technology and innovation. This series explores some of the technologies that are at the cutting edge of healthcare delivery through the medium of the entrepreneurial journeys of some of the founders in our community, as well as the clinicians they have worked with to pilot their technologies.
Daf, it's fantastic to have you on the podcast today. I'm joined by Daf Loughran from Concentric. Daf, would you like to introduce yourself?
Thanks, Megan. It's lovely to be on the pod today. Yeah, so I'm Daf, so a surgeon by training and now CEO and co-founder at Concentric Health. And I know we'll get into a bit more detail, but Concentric is the market-leading digital consent to treatment application. So in its simplest form, that's taking the historic paper consent forms to treatment, procedures, operations, all that kind of stuff, and digitally transforming that process.
Daf, you're obviously at the advanced end of the spectrum, I would say, in terms of the entrepreneurs that we've had on the podcast this season. You've got into a lot of different trusts across the UK. I know that you're also expanding overseas, and we'll talk a little bit about that later. How did you end up sort of selecting digital consent as the thing you wanted to solve for the world? And how has that journey started for you?
Yeah, so I often talk about this story as a kind of journey of 1,000 tiny steps, none of it particularly intentional. And the slightly ironic thing, I think, for many clinicians listening to the pod would be that this all started with an audit. So I did an audit as an F1, as a first year junior doctor, and was basically given that audit to look at variation in consent practices, and was totally struck at that point, you know, a couple of months into my F1 job, there was all this variation and that no one could really say really what we should be discussing with patients, all the kind of this kind of stuff. And it seemed very, very obvious that there should be a better route. And then over the coming few months, you know, I presented that audit data in a few places, and then, you know, a bit of availability bias really, but you start seeing that everyone's sort of talking about this consent problem in all sorts of departmental meetings and all this kind of stuff. And so you just sort of start, you know, it comes into your mindset of, well, we keep talking about this problem, and it seems like the problem is that there's this paper process using blank carbon copy consent forms, and no one really knows what they're meant to be discussing with patients. And so clinicians are in a tricky situation, and patients are not getting a good experience from that conversation, a really, you know, important conversation at a really, you know, critical point in many of these patients' lives. And so, you know, it very much started from that point. I then went to a second year, so F2 job up in Wrexham, up in North Wales, doing orthopedics, and was said on that first Wednesday, right, your job on this firm is to consent the patients for their operations. And I remember that first afternoon, I had to go and get a signature off a lady in her 70s or so for a tibial IM nail. And I remember just walking up to have that conversation with her, totally, totally aware that my job here was to get a signature on a form, and had none of the tools that I needed to be able to input any value into that conversation at all. You know, I'd done 2 weeks of orthopedics in med school, and that was basically my, my learning to go into that conversation. And so, as I think many good, great things in health tech, I basically started building something totally for my own use. So I decided from basically that Wednesday afternoon that I could reasonably straightforwardly build a resource for my own use, which meant that when I was having that walk towards that patient, I could give myself a little bit of knowledge to have a little bit better conversation with that patient. And this was 2012, 2013, at the point where actually it was quite unusual to have mobile phones on the ward. I was in that cohort of junior doctors, the first cohort in Wales to have the Oxford Handbook of Clinical Medicine on your phone. So that's, you know, that first year of junior doctors who had their phones out and had a use case for having their phone out on the wards. And so people, you know, nursing staff and other clinicians would come and ask me, "Oh, Dav, you know, saw you had your phone out. What are you doing with your phone?" And I'd be like, "Oh, I've, you know, started building this, you know, resource of consent information for myself." And those one of those things that just kind of organically seemed to be interesting or curious to others. And so over the next couple of years, mostly in Wales, and particularly as we went from, you know, dual job to job, there'd be some junior doctors who'd be like, "Oh, that sounds super useful and like quite straightforward to do." And so we ended up building some information resources across lots of different specialties, which a group of us junior doctors in Wales would be using. And the, you know, I think the thing that the next step from that, you know, that was very organic, teeny tiny scale. But the interesting thing for that of that for me was that the conversations I was having around that bit of my life and work was very different to those that I was having otherwise clinically. You know, felt much more exploratory, didn't seem to be a defined path. I was just sort of building this thing and some people seemed interested and I'd give them access, and it was kind of, you know, it had its own little world, which felt very different to, you know, the clinical training pathway where you need to do 7 of these, 4 of these, 3.5 of these, you know, to get to the next step. So, you know, fast forward again a little bit, that was enough, you know, that clinical entrepreneur didn't have that title at that point in time. That community of clinicians who were doing something innovative and something maybe entrepreneurial was so small at that time that even in that context of, you know, in many ways a total pet project for mine, you'd end up getting invited to things, to pitches, to, you know, startup schools and all of these sort of thing. And so, you know, people talk about, you know, finding your tribe. That definitely felt to me like finding a tribe in 2014, 2015 or so, enough to make me think, well, I sort of wonder if there's something that route. It wasn't a particularly fast dawn for me, I don't think. I think if you'd have asked me and, or, you know, friends and family in 2014, 2015, they'd have said, "Oh, you know, Dav's totally committed on this sort of surgical journey. I'd done my surgical exams very early. That was sort of what I was doing." But there was this increasing nag in my head of, is there something different? No real clarity around what that looks like. And also, I'm not a particularly brave individual and not one who will take big, bold, grand steps. I'm much more likely to take lots of little inquisitive steps, but I'm willing to say yes. And I think that's you know, an interesting reflection of being willing to say yes and kind of follow that yes without much certainty about where it goes, even without the sort of brashness of a confident yes. So I took this halfway step, really. I decided to go at start of registrar training in urology and did a clinical leadership fellowship, which was one of these programs where it, you know, people do those clinical leadership fellowships often as a, you know, a year out of training and then come back. And for me, I think it was more an opportunity I had to do something slightly parallel, which gave me some time to explore. And I had one of the most amazing conversations, again, on that first Wednesday of changeover with who'd been my education supervisor for that, who was going to be my education supervisor for that year. And I had this sort of program or project that I was meant to be doing for that year. And I sat down with John, and we started discussing the planned project. And I totally distinctively remember John towards the end of that conversation saying, should we just forget about the project? I'm interested to see what you do with a year. And he gave me an unbelievable amount of freedom to go and explore where I thought we could take this small quality improvement hub within a health board in Wales. And that for me was just a totally transformative conversation, going from a very regimented training program to someone having the belief in an individual to say, I'm interested in seeing what you can do. And I think that's one of the things that I hope to take forward as a leader, as we're sort of getting to that point, that ability to believe in an individual.
And what was it like kind of leaving behind your clinical work? Because that obviously meant a lot to you. It must have been quite a transition.
Yeah, it is. And it's, I think some of that was aided by the fact that it was lots of little steps. So I don't think at any point in time I felt as if I was making a super, super clean cut decision to say, I'm in, I'm out. And what I'll say to, you know, lots of people who I have this sort of conversation with in terms of, you know, what was it like leaving medicine and all that kind of stuff, is that I would say that I'm now still totally and utterly in medicine. I think clinically, a huge amount of the time, we'll get into the details of kind of what that looks like. But working in healthtech and having impact in healthcare is in many ways as clinical as you can get. And I talk about impact. We go into medicine or whichever path we go into healthcare to have an impact, not because you need to do things on a one-to-one patient perspective. And that for me has been a guiding, you know, a North Star for me, is to say, okay, there's this one way of looking at impact, which is, you know, my route as a consultant surgeon, as I would have been, you know, around this point in time is when I'd be finishing training. And that there's one, you know, view of impact in healthcare, which is that way. And then there's another view in terms of impact that you can have in digital health and health tech. It's different in many ways. It's a smaller scale impact in terms of individual patients, but the numbers are absolutely, you know, can be absolutely vast. And so my take over the last, you know, few years, so initially I looked at that as, can I convincingly tell myself that I can have more impact in healthcare doing this than I would have done as a consultant surgeon? But then actually as an extension of that, because I think we have passed that point by now, I think I can convincingly say that based on the numbers that we see going through Concentric by now, that I have as much or more impact than I would have done as a consultant surgeon. But a really exciting thing for me is that ability to broaden that impact beyond just me to others who wouldn't have had that ability. So, you know, we see such a boom in amazingly bright people wanting to get into, you know, into software development, software engineering, and there are so many domains that compete for that expertise. And if we can really sell that opportunity for those to have an impact in health, you know, to do great, amazing, fun, cool things in software engineering, but also to have that impact in health, I think that's a huge opportunity. So for us, you know, for me and Concentric by now, one of the kind of vision statements for me is that each person in that company, be they from a clinical background or not, can have more of an impact on healthcare than if each of them was a consultant surgeon.
So it's a fantastic vision and one that I think inspires a lot of people, doesn't it? You know, I think particularly the younger generation are looking for that impact in their work. And so it makes a big difference, as you say, to be able to encourage people to see that impact is a possibility and that there's more than one way to have it. Absolutely. I'm interested in sort of how you feel you've developed personally, Daf. So, you know, kind of what sort of, you've talked a little bit about impact, you've talked a little bit about, you know, sort of supporting people and giving them the space to develop and think about ideas. Interested in sort of what sort of founder you kind of want to be and whether you feel you've managed to get there through your journey with Concentric.
Yeah, so still very young, still a huge amount of growth and learning to be done, but hopefully I have reflected a reasonable amount over the last, you know, 5 or 10 years of a few different transitions. And I think those transitions do give you a perspective on what you're doing and whether that's the right thing and what you're good at and what you're not good at. And I think there's a few things that I reflect on. I think as a child, I think I would have said that I was, you know, a good all-rounder and a good at, you know, a number of different things. As I've got a little older, I think I'm just resilient. I think I just work hard at plugging away at things and stick with a problem longer than most people stick with a problem. So I don't think I'm actually that good at things. I just stick with them and I'm resilient, and that gives you the end result of seeming good at things, but actually you've just plugged away and you've been resilient and you've kept going at things, often, you know, silently in the background. And there's a couple of things from the Concentric journey that are just interesting reflections on that as a process. So there's one in particular that comes to mind around how we got our Innovate UK funding back in 2018. So Concentric, as it, you know, then became, didn't have that name originally, but this idea of doing something around consent and shared decision making was the idea that we kept coming back to, an idea that most people, certainly as a business, you know, we've talked about that curiosity in terms of an aid memoir, but as a business, you know, Ed St. John and I were having most of those conversations at the time, and there were a number of years where that felt like, you know, we'd go to things and people were like, yeah, it's nice, you know, nice idea, nice project, but it's not going to go further than that. But it was just this idea that we kept coming back to, even though most people said not to. And we didn't really know why we kept coming back to it, but we kept doing so. And we'd gone for, you know, a number of different grants and from different number of different places. And we'd submitted a couple of grants to Innovate UK. So Innovate UK being UK RI, UK government, one of the main grant bodies. And two of these smaller 50K grants had been rejected. And then in 2018, nudged by a particular conversation, we were encouraged to go back to Innovate UK with a bigger grant, much bigger grant. So it's a £500,000 grant, or, you know, £500,000 project cost. And we sort of thought, wow, this is, you know, totally speculative, but we've been convinced by a conversation and someone who had a certain you know, idea about what we could do, to go, yeah, okay, well, we'll come back to this one more time, as it were, and submit this grant. Felt very speculative, and initially we got a response back from Innovate UK saying, you know, thanks for your application, but sorry, you've already submitted twice, so we're not going to accept this application. And, you know, at that point you've gone to the process of writing a grant and a grant application, and these things, you know, take a lot of time and take a lot of evenings and weekends and all of that kind of stuff. So we were like, oh gosh, it's so frustrating. So we pleaded and you know, really pushed pretty hard to say, you know, this is different in X and Y way, you know, please just like have a look, take a look at this and at least consider it. We think it's different enough. We think it's interesting. We think it's worthy of not being closed the door on, you know, before being looked at. And then one Friday evening in October 2018, got an email from Innovate UK saying, yeah, successful with that bid. And, you know, it was one of those ones where if we hadn't knocked that door twice more than we probably would have been told by Innovate to knock that door, we, you know, we wouldn't have had that grant, and Concentric wouldn't have wouldn't have started, I don't think, because at that point I was working at Babylon in London. Ed was just finishing a PhD with Lord Darcy. We were doing other things, but it was the sort of side thing that we kept coming back to and needed one person to allow that to get off the starting blocks, which we've been kind of coming back to those starting blocks again and again for whatever reason. So I think resilience is one of those things that I've kept coming back to. There's clearly a caveat around resilience where there are lots of bad ideas and you shouldn't keep going with a bad idea for too long. But there are some of those out there. Those ideas that are just it's a single surprising obsession. No one else quite gets it, but for some reason you keep coming back to it. For some reason you are more obsessed with this idea than other people are. And you have to work out whether that's because it's not a good idea or because it's your superpower. For some reason you are more interested, more obsessed, more resilient about this idea than anyone else would be. And that then is a superpower to do something that others couldn't do with that thought.
And how do you think you make that choice in terms of, is it a good idea or is it, is it no good at all?
Yeah. And I don't think there's an easy answer to that, right? Some of that is luck, some of that is intuition. And I don't think we have the ML algorithms yet to really work out what is intuition. But there's something often in the gut that tells you to proceed with something. And just interesting insights from medicine all over the in all ways of life. But one of those ones around gut is in primary care, a GP's gut of whether something is cancer is better than any algorithm that's yet been devised. There's something pretty powerful in that human subconscious gut feel.
It's surprising, isn't it, how our brains connect together things that are seemingly disparate pieces of information or pieces of evidence that perhaps you don't consciously even think about comparing with each other. And perhaps that adds up, those conversations here and there, those pieces of advice, that, continual frustration with the consent forms, the desire to make an impact, and all of that kind of adds up to actually, this is the right direction to go in. You must have used that resilience of yours quite a bit with your engagement with the NHS as well, Daf, because you've been pretty successful, haven't you, in the UK market. But I don't know whether you found that to be an easy process or whether there have been challenges with that as well.
Yeah, so it's probably worth touching a little bit on where Consentro is by now, because I think it gives a bit of a flavour to that story. So we started with that Innovate UK grant, which I mentioned, in January 2019. Moved back from London to set up a team early 2019. First clinical use in March 2020. And again, one of those things that so many of these stories have, those moments of time that either go one way or the other, and some of it's persistence, some of it is absolutely luck. So we went live basically week one of lockdown, COVID wave one in 2020, and could see minute by minute almost the focus of organizations shifting. And we knew that we had this grant money that was running out, that we needed a first clinical some first clinical use before rolling off that grant, because otherwise there's no second step. And we basically knew that we needed to get the final green light on that 23rd of March, otherwise it would never happen. And it was literally that day, which has been an important day in the world or the UK's history, but also an important day in Concentric's history, sort of bizarrely. But from there we had 4 or 5 hospitals over the next 18 months, all in pilot form. So we did go down the route of unpaid pilots, and have actually been very successful with that route. So those have all converted to paid commercial agreements for us, interestingly, just as a kind of slight counter to lots of the sort of pilotitis challenge that the NHS will continually be kind of used as a sword against the NHS. But and then all about timing, isn't it? So we were getting to a point of the product being reasonably ready, you know, to be rolled out at scale towards the end of 2021, and then early 2022 came elective recovery funding and consent, alongside a few other things, pre-assessment, etc., were in this bucket of products that might help with your elective recovery from a digital perioperative pathway perspective. And so very, very quickly then, essentially in a quarter in early 2022, went from a point of having some unpaid pilots to actually having 20 trust-wide NHS contracts. So yeah, I mean, a slightly manic quarter, and totally transformed what this business looked like from a commercial perspective. And so yeah, and then we've essentially from that point had a much steadier, but I think a very sensible growth curve. So we're now in around 40 NHS trusts in England. Most of our use is in England. We have a couple of big private hospital groups that use Concentra as well. But vast majority is in the UK, and we're just starting to look overseas. So we now have a couple of employees outside the UK, one in Spain and one in Australia. And Australia is a particularly kind of a first step for us to say, we thought we'd get to exporting a couple of years ago, but actually the UK market became so hot, you know, in terms of elective recovery funding and all those sort of things, that we had to focus on that hot first market. And have now, you know, finally got to that point of having an employee outside the UK to go and say, okay, this product has been really popular in the UK, seems to deliver benefits for patients and clinicians and organizations. Is that replicable outside the UK, outside of the kind of public sector and private sector in the UK? And so watch that space, because that's, you know, early days for us.
That must bring with it a bit of a change in gear for you as the founding team as well. I imagine, you know, you're now somehow in charge of a fairly large team of people, an international company, an ongoing portfolio. I mean, has that changed the way you lead the team?
I think getting to, so we're 10 people in 10 people full time in the UK and a couple overseas by now. It forces the issue, certainly, in terms of being able to delegate, forces you to really think about which parts of the business do you need to be absolutely in the weeds of. And I'm, you know, I am a fan of being in the weeds to a certain extent. You know, there lots of people will say, you know, work on the business, not in the business. I think that's true to a certain extent, but I think there's also a counter to say, you know, be in it, understand it, understand the nooks and crannies of it, so that you can make the right, you know, strategic decisions, the right team decisions, the right culture decisions, that you're part of that culture, all of that kind of stuff. So it's one of those sentences I think I've heard from many, many advisors over the last decade, is work on the business or in the business. And I tend to have half an agreement and half a disagreement with that statement. But yeah, no, there's certainly that challenge of finding that balance, right? Because you have to not be a blocker as you scale, because otherwise you just become a blocker in too many ways, you know, every day. And it's not only, you know, slows the business, but it's frustrating individually for those who are, you know, the other side of that block. And so that for me, as a personal thing, I think is a challenge. You know, I think for lots of founders, that is a challenge. You've spent the first often years of a business absolutely knowing everything about this business, and every, you know, there's nothing that goes on almost in anybody's head in the business that you're not aware of. And you know, releasing that in certain areas, and sometimes that's, you know, that has to be fluid. So sometimes you release and then you go, actually, you know, I do need to be a little bit more involved in that piece because that has this knock on here, here, here. And so I want to be, you know, I thought I'd delegate all of that, but actually I want, you know, this bit of that process I really want to be part of, so that it's all, you know, set up in the right way and that sort of thing. So yeah, that's definitely a challenge, and I by no means would say that we're where we will want to be from that perspective in 2 years, 3 years time, but are trying to get there, trying to understand where to sort of hold, where to really understand the nooks and crannies as we grow, because, you know, processes do develop. We, you know, lots of the stuff gets formalized around this point in time. You've gone from a really small group of people who sort of know all the processes, just you don't, it doesn't really need to be written down in any way, and so formalizing these processes and knowing the path through there and speaking to those who are just, there's always someone a couple of steps ahead, and generally these challenges and scaling challenges are very, very similar. You know, each business has their little quirks and nuances, but the themes are generally pretty similar. Different people will take different approaches. You may agree or disagree, but having a small cohort of people who you can go to, who you trust their opinion, trust their sort of their insights from their journey, you know, a year ago, 2 years ago, I think is a really important thing. And then, yeah, I mean, so Patrick moving out to Australia a few weeks ago, getting used to now waking up to a Slack which is full of messages from all the things that Patrick has been doing overnight. From you know, previously, you know, you'd wake up and, you know, Slack and email and these kind of stuff were sort of as you left them last night, but now there's all this activity that's gone overnight, and it's kind of a slightly different thing to wake up to. So yeah, it's been a kind of an interesting, just a little nugget of the last few weeks is going, so waking up slightly bleary eyed, shouldn't really look at my phone at that point, but I do, and being like, oh gosh, okay, all right, loads of messages, right? What do I do with these? But yeah, lots of, you know, that's a fun challenge, right? That's a fun challenge.
It's 24/7 business now, even more so than it was before, Daf, which is, yeah, a bit of a challenge. It's interesting, though, I think, talking to you, because, you know, you've clearly made some of your own choices about a lot of things that, you know, people get advice on over the years as an entrepreneur. Things like sort of saying, well, actually, we did go for some unpaid pilots and actually they've worked quite well for us. You know, things like sort of saying, well, actually, I do like to be involved in the weeds in some of the business. And I think these sorts of choices are very much personal choices and choices that everyone has to make for themselves, with a combination of guts and, you know, advice from mentors and coaches and things like that, and just sort of working out in a sense what works for them, what works for their business, their founding team, their type of product, because, you know, there's so much variation, I think, between different ways of doing things. And sometimes people do get a bit too hooked up on the rubrics, a bit too hooked up on the you must never do this, you must always do that. I'm interested, Daf, in just reflecting a little bit on your local engagement with Oxford University Hospitals. You know, I think that Lydia and Susan will be joining us on the podcast to talk about their experience of piloting Concentric. And I was interested in your feelings and your thoughts, reflecting on kind of all those pilots you've done across the NHS, but and then specifically the one at Oxford. How do you feel those have gone? Have you experienced certain challenges? Have they all been the same, or have they all been quite different? What's your experience of piloting in the NHS?
Yeah, so feels like a good time to give the Hill a slight nod. So, you know, I think it's impossible to talk about what we've done or doing at OUH without talking about the Hill. So our involvement at the Hill came off the back of being PitchFest finalists at Digital Health Rewired, and, you know, as most companies like us, we've done a number of different accelerators, Digital Health London, we did Google for Startups, kind of UK immersion program for 10 high growth companies, you know, a handful of these. And I think my take on that unique proposition that the Hill has is that link with OUH. It's it is unique in that way, to be sat close enough to an NHS trust to genuinely have impact within the walls of that trust. You know, many accelerators do lots of other things well, but as an arm's length body, it is very hard to have any impact within a single trust. And so I think that is for me the thing that came from the Hill, was that it opened some doors within a pretty tricky organization to get into. I think lots of people would say, in terms of OUH, the name carries so much at OUH, and it's a big, it's a big organization, it's a complex organization, and so that is hugely valuable for us in terms of opening those doors. In terms of reflections on the NHS and different organizations, as I said, 40 or so NHS trusts that we've rolled out within by now, it is always surprising to me, I think, the variation in complexity of those rollouts. We're in a setup where we pretty much, there's little things that we do slightly differently depending on the context, but pretty much we have a playbook that we try and use for our delivery, and we sort of do the same thing regardless of whether you're, whether you're in Oxford or someone totally different. But the complexity on the other side of the fence is very noticeable. It's certainly 10x difference, and that's in right across things. So there's some places where the timescales are so different, right? So there's some places where we'll see a rollout go very much in the sort of 2 months time frame, where we go from decision to adopt to clinical go live, and there's others where it's easily 12 months, and sometimes even more than that, and not from any difference on our side, but it's the difference in the number of processes that a deploying team within that trust need to go through. And I still haven't worked out any way to predict how complex that's going to be, and I'm not often even within the trust, those sat on that side of the fence, and not clear how complicated the process is going to be. You uncover things as you go through that. Not always. There are some places where there are digital teams or innovation teams that are really well, they've it's not their first rodeo, it's not their fifth rodeo, it's not their 10th rodeo. They sort of very much know what the process is going to be and what that looks like, and have a realistic view of what that would be. But it's those time frames things but all the way through that sort of stack of things that show complexity, there's some places where a project call has two people, a project manager on our side and a project manager on trust side, and hopefully a clinical lead. And then there's other places where the same call has 30 people on them, and I have no idea who most of them are, when you get to those sides, but there's something in the organization that means that's the MO for those sort of things. And I'm definitely not one who's going to come on a podcast and say, here's how the NHS should be, and here's the golden bullet for solving that complexity. There are others who will have much stronger opinions and spend much more time thinking about that stuff than I, but my pure reflection, sat one step away, is that a startup, a digital health company, can be doing exactly the same thing, but there's easily 10x difference in complexity, and that is the number of people who seem to need to be involved in a project, the number of people who need to go through and approve a project, and 10 times here, 10 times here, 10 times here becomes, 1,000 times the complexity suddenly, isn't it? So I don't have a solution, but it's interesting to see the variation.
Do you have any advice for people who are sort of looking to work with the NHS and as to how they should approach that?
Yeah, so I think the one thing I have said to some is that, given that variation, choosing your first and second sites is really important. And so choosing those sites that have got that down, got that process nailed, is really important, because I remember thinking, our first deployment, was long and hard and complex, And, you know, there are lots of reasons for that. And there's lots of reasons why the first is more complicated, because you don't have, you know, you don't have the documentation process in place, you don't have X and Y processes. So that is always sort of going to be the case. The first one is going to be more tricky. But if you can make sure that your first deployment is also not in one of the most complicated places, you know, I think those multiples really come into play there. But if you can do that first deployment in somewhere that is lighter afoot and knows the path, can guide you through that, then it can make that first one feel so different. And often it's sort of difficult to know. And sometimes I speak to people and they're like, oh gosh, we're totally, you know, lost in the weeds of this. You know, it's our first deployment and we're going through X and Y and Z. And, you know, sometimes I say to people, well, there's a huge amount of variation in what different places need you to do, and how many processes, meetings you need to go through. And so sometimes that is saying, well, actually, maybe that isn't the right place for a first deployment. And I think innovators have to say, it's not that the NHS is not the right place to innovate and do healthcare. But there are some places that it's really hard to make your first deployment. And so just being aware of that variation, not necessarily thinking, oh God, they're all this way. And so, you know, we tried to do it in the NHS, but that first one was so impossible that we decided to never go there again. But to say, actually, was that us? It will have been a certain amount us. Was it somewhat to do with the organization? Could you find a different organization that would guide that first deployment easily, you know, make that feel a little bit easier? And then the world opens up, right? Once you're through that first deployment, then all subsequent conversations are different. So how do you get through that first one? And how do organizations make themselves the place where that works?
And you're obviously going to be doing that all over again in your new countries, I guess, Steph. What's next for Concentric and for you personally? What does the future hold?
Yes, I think there's three parts, really. So firstly, you know, there's still a lot to do in that first market. So our main competitor is still paper consent forms. I'm definitely a fan of not doing a little bit and then kind of getting distracted and moving on to the next thing, as we've sort of talked about. So there's still a huge amount of growth within the UK to say, actually, you know, this is the new standard. If you're not realizing the benefits of digital in the consent and shared decision making space, then you should be an outlier. And I think, you know, we are getting to that point, and we will stick at that until we're really there. So, you know, that's one thing. Clearly there's the excitement of, you know, firstly working out, can we make this work in other countries? And, you know, that for me is broadening that impact, coming back to impact again and again. Can we do that elsewhere? Can we take this small group of individuals and say they can now have a global impact, not just an individual patient impact, not just an impact within a single hospital, not just an impact within the UK, but at a global scale. So you know, that's the second part, and all the complexities that come with that from, you know, regulatory perspective, clinical perspective, systems perspective, that, you know, there's so many things that come into a market entry plan. And then first, the other part is the opportunity to do like deeper things within consent. So there is an opportunity to go from the historic situation of there being some accepted information about what the outcomes or risk profiles of having a procedure are, regardless of who you are, pretty much, to a situation where you can genuinely say, okay, Megan, if you're having this procedure in this context, these are your outcomes. Because we know, you know, at a population level, whilst it's valuable and it supports the conversation. There are still so many surprises along those treatment pathways, which I think we can get much better at. I think we're getting to a point in terms of machine learning models and things and the ability to capture this data, because we have easier ways to do that digitally, etc., that we can, over the coming years, go from a setting that we say, okay, here's what a random person might expect in terms of a risk profile for a procedure, to saying, here's actually what what you can expect from this journey and what that risk really looks for like for you. Because it seems very obvious in some cases, it's a bit more nuanced in many other ways, but if you are having a hip replacement compared to a 90-year-old that live next door to you, your outcomes would clearly be very, very different. But we're not good at knowing or communicating that difference in healthcare as of yet. Getting there, and the kind of hips and knees are probably one example where there is some of that data, but it's a very thin slice of the number of people going through these conversations that we have really useful personalized data. So that's another opportunity for us, is to go deeper, personalize, not get distracted and do these other things, these other products that we can do, but keep majoring on consent, shared decision making, going deeper there. My pet peeve is clinical applications that are vaguely okay, and the people have clearly got them to a point where they can sell them, and then they've moved on to the next thing. No one should expect Concentric to do that.
I think having spoken to you today and knowing you already, Daph, I don't think there's any concerns on that with you. I mean, you clearly have that superpower of being able to focus on something and delve deeper into it and very much create something that hopefully will have that impact that you want to have, which is fantastic. Daph, it's been fantastic to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it and look forward to checking in a few years' time when all this new stuff is on the horizon. It'll be interesting to see how everything pans out for you.
Thank you so much. Absolutely amazing to join you today. Thanks.
You've been listening to the Hill's Digital Innovation Podcast. Find out more about our work bringing digital technologies into the NHS at www.thehilloxford.org. You'll see details of our open access events, as well as applications to programmes such as our flagship Market Access Accelerator for startups looking to work with the NHS. Don't forget to also check out Series 1 and 2 of the podcast.